Welcome to Tactical Permaculture. I've worked on projects ranging from the poorest to richest clients, from inner cities to suburbs to farmlands to remote wilderness, from the eco-war front lines to celebrity backyards. In over 25 years of service to the earth and the community of life, I've learned that in the fight for sustainable survival, growing is half the battle. Please go to tacticalpermaculture.com to read my blog, watch my videos, view my photos, access web applications, and click on the join membership link to access exclusive features. March 26th, 2024, episode number 123. I'm just going to be using this opportunity to sort out some philosophical and geopolitical, political, economic, confusing ideas and terms. Now that I would say I'm giving equal time and attention to the center, the left, and the right, as it were. And, of course, being selective and, of course, with my own biases, picking and choosing what voices, what sources of news and analysis from each of those lanes. And trying to, the more I learn, the more I study, the more perspectives I digest, really the more confusing it gets and the harder it is for me to define and really intelligibly compare any of these things. So I'm going to try to verbalize it because there's a lot going on, and all I want to do really with all this stuff is just get past the rhetoric and the tribalism and seek the common ground, because to me the higher purpose is to take responsibility for the state of ecology. And if rights are going to be fought for, then obviously human rights, civil rights. And for me, I'm skeptical and hesitant to lend any credence to even the concept of rights, because to me it is a relative term of being governed and having to ask people who aren't your parents, who you're not even related to, asking them to give you rights as if you don't already have them. So to me, I use the term unnatural power or natural freedom. I mean, it doesn't matter to me what the words are, it's just semantics at a certain point. But I always felt it was disempowering to petition the state for rights. We don't have many other options, because there aren't many stateless areas left on earth, or people within states who are free and self-sufficient enough to not have to buy into or pay into the tithing to the king with taxes. And we're all pretty much stated now. We're stater's gonna state, and we're all pretty much stated. And not, I mean, you can do what I'm doing, which is slowly extricate and disentangle from every last tentacle that you can possibly identify, till you get to the point where you really understand where the extent of that grip goes, and how no matter how far away you go, no matter how self-sufficient you become, what is left is still a death grip. So you have all kinds of different perspectives on freedom and autonomy and the role of the state. So I try to just, how do I simplify it? How do I understand it and sort through the cults of personality and the groupthink and the dogma, indoctrination, all that. So I'm going to do my best here to kind of synthesize where I'm at with my studies. And to me, it's all very George Carlin. I mean, that's the way I want to feel about it, because I want to be able to, from a bird's eye view, just identify the absurdity of all very rigid ideologies, which I think he did a good job of. He was able to make fun of everybody, but still maintain a position of being just generally hostile and critical towards authoritarianism, which now more than ever, there's nowhere to hide from it in the left or the right. The authoritarianism seems to be the tendency just of cults of personality, and how charismatic or pushy leaders, although going back all the way to the school playground, playing King of the Hill, and the high school jocks, nerds, and cheerleaders triad, there's just always dominant personalities that shape the attitudes and the values, because they control some form of capital, whether it's popularity on the school ground or capital as adults in various stations in life, where people have political power and social clout and whatnot. Try to see through all of that and see everybody is basically full of BS, including yourself. So if I look at it that way, I think what's the funny, and I'm not using an AI bot to replicate George Carlin, which was done recently, which is just too ironic to imagine. But for me, since the Vietnam War and civil rights protests, that in the cycles of mass movements, let's say at least within the United States, but it was an international movement. But for me, zooming out, it seems like I was lucky enough to catch the cyclical wave of resistance about a little more than 20 years, maybe. You could say 20 to 30 years, approximately, between the peak. Yeah, somewhere between. I don't know exactly how you would bracket the peak of anti-war, anti-Vietnam War, and the peak of civil rights. They're roughly aligned, but not exactly. I wouldn't say they were exactly aligned, but so approximately a generation or so ish. There are people more studied and learned than me that would actually be able to chart all this out on a map of time, but I'm just roughly sketching it to say I feel lucky that my generation, and when people say generation, the best definition, not a textbook definition, but the best one that I've heard, is that we define a generation by what people were doing in their early 20s. And that's such an interesting way of thinking about it, because really that's where when we talk about a snake eating a rodent and what it looks like for as they're swallowing it, for this lump to go through, that's like they use that metaphor just in talking about population and whatnot. There's some kind of outlying parameter, whether it's numeric or otherwise. There's just this glut that occurs, moves along the timeline, And to me, that symbolizes just the inertia, the momentum of people in their 20s, what their values are, what their convictions are, what they're willing to fight for or fight against at a time when they have maximum self-perceived invincibility, maximum hormonal fuel, if you will, and just a time in the development of the brain and the nervous system where social bonding and identity and fitting into a group and having very positional identitarianism and whatnot, that is concentrated in a human lifespan in those early 20s years. And it also coincides with being on campus for a lot of people who go to college, as I did. And all of those, it's a perfect storm with all of those internal factors, all the chemical, biological, neurological factors that make it the sort of peak of your politicization potential, really. Your potential to be mobilized into resistance. And you can afford it if you have a pretty much a free ride the way I did in college. I didn't have to work because I was articulate enough even at that age of whatever it was, 19, when I got accepted to a relatively not Ivy League, but it was in the bottom of the barrel in terms of the University of Oregon. But I got myself a full ride, a little bit of a Pell Grant, but a what they called a Dean Scholarship, so that I was free enough. Of course, took on a tiny bit of debt, but essentially was free enough to pay my bills, and which included copious amounts of cigarettes and beer, and was able to spend my free time partying with intellectuals inside and outside of the student body, because it was Eugene, Oregon, with a vibrant sort of aging hippie population and an environmentalist ecological forest defense movement rooted in Earth First, and it kind of had more radicalized offshoots of that. So the milieu was multiple generations of environmental radical extremist thinkers, and then a sort of recruitment base of young, gung-ho college student environmental activists who were maintaining student groups that had been around for probably decades and sustaining those school-funded groups so that there would be some infrastructure for this, for the maintenance and the growth, the sort of scaffolding to always be there to help build the next generation of forest defenders and human rights activists and whatnot. So I would say I was blessed to be situated in space and time to be at a university that was very sophisticated intellectually in terms of shaping the minds of warriors at the time when they're most receptive and most energized and motivated and free in terms of availability to go to conferences and workshops and join organizations and volunteer. And for all intents and purposes, very few people at that age were breeding, or we were using forms of contraception. We were, so you get the idea, but the priority was resistance and not dropping out. For me, I did well. I got straight A's and had a above 4.0 GPA and still was able to do that and still be engaged in all these activities because I didn't have to work thanks to that those grants and scholarships. So, and a little bit of loans, to be fair. But that, so to me, when I say back in my day, catching the wave of movements of resistance, the de jure sort of umbrella category that I think historians would now use, and I don't know if we would have believed that it would all be kind of clumped together under this title at the time, but because there were all kinds of different political ideologies, and each one of us, we all thought that it was our proprietary revolution that anyone could join, but they had to discard any other system of beliefs lest they be harangued for not drinking the Kool-Aid and flying the flag, the us and them flag, us versus them flag. So we would have said it's our such and such revolution. We wouldn't have said it's a generation in their prime doing what all generations do in their prime, which is pick a cause and try to end up with an emergent property despite their best efforts to tear each other down, end up in some broad category where they're all kind of were doing the same thing. And so if we would have said there was a labor movement, a women's movement, a gay movement, a civil rights movement, an anti-war movement, immigrant movements, all these different brackets of people in their prime fighting for what was to be fought for in at that time, and mostly that does appear to be the radical left fighting against the grinding gears of capitalism and the defenders of it, which are stereotypically right-wing conservative business owners, which I'll get to in a minute, like how I try to make sense of all that. And to me, that's just the fact. I mean, we're not even factoring in secular versus Christian or religious, which is all intertwined with all of it, makes it so you have this collusion and perverse bedfellows of poor people, rich people, grouped together against their fundamental prerogatives in terms of governing their, yeah, I mean, if the bosses and the profiteers, the capitalists, want to drive down wages, and the poor people want to form unions and strike in order to have more higher wages, but they set all that aside to prevent women from having abortions, then it really distorts the simple binaries, the black and white dichotomies of class war. Like, to me, what's happening now, this term populism is interesting, because if you can serve the interests of the elite and yet you can manipulate and speak to the underdog and galvanize them under banners of hyper-religiosity, then you can basically short-circuit class war. But I don't want to get ahead of myself, because I'm trying to build this brick by brick here in terms of setting up to the point where those more emergent properties of analysis can make sense. But just to frame myself now, kind of having spoken about my understanding of movements and within at least U.S. history, and let me let me break down civil rights more than what you would just typically think of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and all of the leaders within the black African American fight for rights and autonomy and safety and security and a fair shot at the so-called American dream and everything else. I mean, you had Black Panthers along with all different types of groups in the South. I'm not going to enumerate all of the different groups I'm aware of across the spectrum, but it's quite immense. But it's very important to me also to acknowledge the American Indian movement and you could group the uprisings of the American Indian movement within civil rights, but it's, to me, it's it transcends that category because it is truly the oldest struggle of the Western Hemisphere since Columbus era, and often gets minimized and overlooked because of the ratios of population numbers, as if because they've been tucked away in reservations that they're somehow out of the scope of shaping historical events, that they've already been marginalized so much that you have to look for the pockets of resistance. But it is still everywhere, and certainly I don't think people in the United States have much of a clue about how raging the indigenous resistance movements are in Canada, and how in Latin America it's so interesting to think about indigenous resistance from Canada to the U.S. through Mexico into Central and South America, and all of the different shades of language colonization and blood colonization, and what the state of affairs is for the last First Peoples actually still living on the land and living by the old ways. So for me, I didn't have an ethnic battle to fight other than to acknowledge my white privilege and to step back when asked to, or when I was conscientious enough to say let women and people of color take up space in movements and in discourse, and for me to understand that I felt like I don't belong on this continent, and I was made to feel like I don't belong on this continent, and rather than shout they will not replace us, I shouted, if I'm here and I can't afford to leave, I'm going to be of service and help the people who are more oppressed than me. After all, I wouldn't be the only warrior to have a mantra of liberate the oppressed. There's something intrinsic about the visceral, non-academic, street level, gut level, this is wrong, this is tyranny, this is exploitation. Where are the deepest wounds? Show me where to apply myself, and I will surrender the microphone and the bullhorn, and if I had it, I would surrender money in order to serve the movements where the wounds were deepest. And certainly that's not me, Mr. kind of low end, not trailer trash, but close enough, but lower middle class, barely even suburban-ish, but certainly not sheltered and not rich and very much latchkey poverty line. Still none of the none of the deeper wounds of indigenous and people of color and women. So I guess that makes me an advocate for the lower class and then those most abused within it. So I guess I'm a leftist liberal bleeding heart, is what they called it. And then you have animals in the environment, not in any particular order of hierarchy, but in the terms of who's being abused by those with power and money who form parties and manipulate politics in order to protect themselves from liability for all of that abuse and to be able to perpetuate it at larger scales. So the word that I have been working up to is the unlikely word that I wouldn't have thought would define the times, but the term that defined the times in my generation's era of resistance, it was anti-globalization. We used the term anti-globalization because we organized events and conferences, and you call it the WTO, the World Trade Organization protest, the battle in Seattle. Yeah, I was there. And I wasn't there to put flowers in gun barrels, I'll tell you that much. But luckily I was intelligent in my operational judgment and was able to evade being corralled into mass arrest and was able to escape and evade batons and couldn't get past the whatever it was. It felt like it had to be nerve gas, but it couldn't avoid the being gassed, but did avoid blunt force trauma and arrest, but was able to hold the line and other things that don't need to be spoken of. But yeah, that was the Woodstock for the anti-globalization movement. And here we are with that being the sort of that kicked off a whole series of anti-globalization mass protests around the world. That the further it seemed like the further away from the United States, the more violent they got, because there's more of a tradition of street battle mainly in Europe, where there's some sort of chivalry where they don't just lock you up for 25 years for jaywalking there at a protest. That's such a police state here that there's really no honor in street battle, because they'll just mangle your life and fine you and put you in prison forever if you dare to fight back against overzealous, brutal police. You don't have the respect as a warrior that you would get in places in Europe where the police are happy to be just as lawless as you are. And if they corner you in an alley, they're going to knock your teeth out and maybe not even bother to take you in to book you and arrest you. They'll just have fun just being a gang bludgeoning people. And they're used to being lit on fire with Molotov cocktails as well and being pelted by rocks. And so it's not a fair fight, but legally speaking, for some reason, it's treated more like a sport, because of the history of labor movements and green movements and just a healthier relationship with people's popular rebellion all throughout Europe. So I always said to myself, man, I'm in the wrong country. I could not afford to be a anti-globalization protest follower the way a lot of people in my time, they were following the Grateful Dead decades ago. My generation, those who could afford it, were going protest hopping from one to the next across the world. I was very jealous because I only got to go to local little mini street protests, but I did get to go to WTO, the battle in Seattle, which was cool. But and the battle in LA too. I got to be at the DNC protest, which was all part of that continuum. And boy, that was a lot of fun. And I was lucky again to escape the worst of the brutality and yet hold the line. So that's me being nostalgic about back in my day. But the reason why I even go into any of that is to try to understand these tendencies now, how these tendencies sort of interact over time. And so if we're whatever now, 25 years. I mean, when is the 25th anniversary of the WTO? I think it was November 99. So that would be, if my math, I can't blame a police baton for having bad math, but I think that would mean that it's possible that it could be this very year, in November, that we would have the 25th anniversary of the WTO protest. Damn, that's scary. That's, I don't want to, just like Robert Sapowski said, the evolution, or he was, I don't know exactly what his title is, but the prominent scientist, Robert Sapowski, who said, I'm turning, when he said it on an interview, he said, I'm turning 60 soon and I'm not going to be very mature about it. That was great. So I'm feeling not very mature about myself getting up there in years, and to think about the 25th anniversary of WTO protest. Damn, where are we all now? We need to have a reunion. But so anti-globalization movement 25 years later, well, it's worth acknowledging that the momentum of that movement, it could have been more successful, but for 9/11 essentially empowering government crackdown on organizing with a new department and new budget and carte blanche Patriot Act powers to extinguish and go and to, yeah, carte blanche powers to extinguish pretty much all resistance to, at that time, the administration and its prerogative. So that was the end of that. That really, most people would say that the chilling effect of those, and I actually lived with someone who was one of the first leftists to be convicted under the Patriot Act. So, yeah, I mean, what more evidence do you need than a personal anecdote like that, that it wasn't Islamic terrorists who were the sole targets of that dragnet of resistance. It was everybody, including the relatively benign and powerless and tactically foolish and disadvantaged left teenagers. Pretty much all got extinguished with a sort of soft power, the threat of increased sentences, the threat of almost like a RICO act for protesting, which, as a matter of fact, is timely in the news now even. But if the anti-globalization movement was over as fast as it started, but we were keying into something that was happening with NAFTA and GATT and these free trade agreements, where if I was to put it in an elevator pitch or just to summarize it, it was the idea that there was a coalition being built between the labor movement, which is not generally radically leftist anymore, even if it was in a different era. It certainly is not so much now, or it wasn't so much then. I don't even know what's left of it now comparatively, but there was a coalition building effort between the victims of globalization in the United States, which are obviously all the fronts of the environmental movement, the victims of progress in terms of nature and the land, and then obviously the disenfranchised, the poor working class, but the workers themselves, the industrial workers, factory workers, manual laborers, whose wages would be driven to the bottom in competition with free trade partners around the world who had more lax environmental and labor laws so that they could be exploited, their natural resources and their human capital could be exploited to degrees that American civil rights and environmental rights activism had mitigated, and thus raised the minimum wage and made it more costly to run a strip mine and run a warehouse. You had to take care of and protect the health of your workers. There's the EPA, there's OSHA, there's all kinds of regulations that add up in terms of the cost of doing business in the U.S. So factories started closing down, popping up in the border of Mexico, the maquiladoras, the outsourcing and downsizing. And you had the Michael Moore documenting a lot of these, the early stages of globalization and global free trade being this Orwellian term that kind of whitewashed and even sometimes greenwashed the worst atrocities of capitalism. And from just turning the security forces of the world into death squads defending corporate pillage, it was very clear. And it was affecting people in ways that were undeniable, and if you were in the working class, but you were not typically radically leftist, you would start to get the point, get the idea. Oh, maybe the boss doesn't have my best interest in mind. Maybe my church is just here to tell me that it's all God's plan for me to be poor, and I shouldn't rebel. If depending on which church you're in, there's churches that are certainly far more rebellious. But yeah, it was an interesting time for there to be this Venn diagram where typically conservative people had common ground in the street battling to prevent the global race to the bottom of regulation and wages. So there's all kinds of different terms. I don't feel like after a certain point I didn't want to spend all my time becoming an expert in all these fields that you would have to be an expert in to understand what terms like neoliberalism and neocons. I mean, what couldn't you just say that about every generation, that it's all new, it's all the next iteration? To me the deeper critiques that span longer periods of time, before Marxism, before Luddism, going all the way back to the most primal resistance against colonization. So for me, I look at globalization going all the way back to the time of the seafaring explorers working for kings and queens and basically looting the earth at the point of swords on horseback to enslave indigenous people and to extract gold. I mean, go back in time further, and just it's the nature of empire to conquer and colonize, and all of the terms that we apply to that behavior now, I think they just make it more confusing. Jared Diamond, Howard Zinn, the works of scholars who really put it in a broader historical perspective. To me, that's all one fight. That's all. You choose a side of people. What John Trudell said: people, there's a way to live with Earth, and there's a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. That's about as simple and straightforward as it can be. And it's not, that's not confusing to figure out. Where are you, where are your biological waste products going? Where are the, where's the packaging of your products going? What's the legacy of the materials that you use on a daily basis? How many trees had to be cut down for you to have shelter? What are you doing to repair and build soil with your biological waste products and with your hands, and in order to be a subsistence gardener or hunter-gatherer, being a part of a food chain where you're actually serving the immediate ecology? To me, it's as simple as that. Anything that's a, anything abstracted from human ecology at a that primal scale, for me, it's all corrupt, it's all bastardized, and it all leaves a toxic legacy, and it's not sustainable. So whatever, whether you're on the left or the right or the center, if you're not living of earth in balance and harmony with wisdom and limits to your ingenuity to mess with nature to create shiny, flashy things to fill landfills with and to corrupt the minds of young people with all infinite stream of apps and scrolling, like if that's the best humanity has accomplished, the greatest achievement, and in its wake it leaves nothing but a wasteland and a smoldering cinder that we have to go to Mars to escape, then that's to me an epic fail. So call me, call it deep ecology or primitivism or whatever you want. I don't really even care about those labels anymore. Although I used to be very religious about the flags that I flew in my peak. But here we are 25 years later since the birth and the rapid rise and fall of the anti-globalization movement, which was unsuccessful. That's why there's, I mean, I'm the last person who's going to cry about there being no manufacturing sector in the economy of the U.S. being gutted and outsourced because of globalization and the failure of the anti-globalization movement, which I blame on 9/11 and not the movement itself. But here we are 25 years later, and the U.S. economy, for one, is over-leveraged in outsourced labor. Therefore, we're all in a tertiary service industry-oriented economy that's now being replaced by AI. So we're essentially obsolete and useless as consumers, which seems to be... And then, of course, the wealth disparity. That's the funny thing all along, is that I did not know. I only learned recently. I'm surprised it just slipped by after all my leftist scholarship, that there were times in American history where the highest percentage of taxation was far higher than it's ever been in my lifetime. So really, the ruling class has nothing to complain about, and all of the chicanery that's engaged in for them to avoid taxes, all taxes, to create offshore tax shelter, shell games and whatnot. I mean, they got it good. But then you have, yeah, again, there was a sort of an aftershock of anti-globalization movement post-financial collapse in 2008, which was the Occupy Wall Street and then Occupy Main Street all over the country. I don't know how far out around the world, but we are the 99%, and it wasn't always that drastic of a wealth disparity, even though there have been times and places under feudalism where I mean, that'd be interesting. I'm not sure. I'm curious now. Someone scholarly would be able to answer this. Is the wealth disparity now, is it better or worse than in the most extreme feudal times, where you had no rights and no land ownership amongst the peasants? But interestingly, they lived better, healthier, probably sometimes longer lives, even as feudal peasants, all throughout the world, just because it was all organic and it was all down to earth and they were living and working with the soil and in the land and in villages. So arguably a better life. Now we have probably just as abysmal of a wealth disparity, if not more, in certain places. And we have a toxic, psychologically, mentally, socially damaged fabric of society, and then a toxic wasteland of genetically modified and chemically sprayed foods that give us cancer and keep us obese and in the hospital, falling apart and living miserably, dare I say. So ironic enough, you could have been more technically, legally powerless and more financially exploited in earlier generations, yet be living more like in the Garden of Eden in terms of your human ecology. And there were a lot of places in feudalism where they didn't care what you believed. There was no enforcement of a religion, or the government was not surveilling and peering into every aspect of life. It was like once a year or once a season, give us this much weight, this much tonnage of your harvest, and we will see you next year. You don't show up with what, you don't give us what we need, you're going to have problems. So give us what we ask for to go fight our wars. And Pax Romana. Did I say that right? I don't know. But that's empire. Surprise, surprise. So now what I think is funny and cute and adorable and absurd is this this new, well, I don't know how new it is, but it's popularized. It's been popularized within the libertarian and to some degree so-called right wing. But it's this word that I'm hearing more often now, which is globalist. So if there's to be a globalist, there has to be a thing such as globalism, because there has to be an ism for you. There has to be an ism for you to be an ist, I think is how that would work. So I'm studying more of the wealthy left, the libertarian sort of establishment of libertarians who are not bleeding heart leftists who want socialism because they want to preserve their wealth and they want a minimal state that will at least provide them the physical security for their property and their assets, but nothing more. I'm not trying to be crude or reductionistic. I mean, I'm learning from everyone now. I'm not closed off the way I was in my little cult of the left back in the day. Now I'm very interested because of my age, my aging, I'm a little maybe maturing, because I've matured intellectually and because I have something to lose financially. I have more time in my day to stomach libertarian rhetoric, because now I kind of understand. I'm not in the highest tax bracket for sure, but I also am not dead broke, and I'm a landowner now. You know, I'm not a landless peasant. I'm a landed peasant at this point. So I have to think about what people with things to lose have to think about, which is government overreach and eminent domain and property taxes and all the things that make you want to engage politically in a different way, other than just tear it all down and we're going to squat and we don't care about anything. And I mean, we care about everything, and so that therefore we care not to comply with anything, because we're in full rebellion, full resistance, and we got nothing to lose. Lock us up, break our teeth, we're going to give it our all because we have no choice. Then you get to where someone like I, where I'm at, which is not in the middle class, I'm certainly still in the lower class. I just have a little tiny nest egg and a little tiny postage stamp to try to live my own cabin in the woods. But it's a truck stand in the desert instead of a cabin in the woods. But dropping out of society, disengaging from it, and just trying to stay away from all of its risks and liabilities and battles that I think are mostly polishing the brass in the Titanic anyway. But I have a privilege to say that, because I know how to grow food, and I can afford to buy the food I can't grow yet. So I don't have to beg anymore. And I don't have to be succumb to the police brutality that is heaped upon landless peasants, beggars, and homeless encampments in the street. Although that is exactly where I came from, I just happened to be working class car dweller in LA on Skid Row. But I came from Skid Row to be a squatter on my own land with meager means and literally no shelter other than a truck camper that I built with bamboo and a friend who had a friend in the hood who had the means to chop up the frame of a ladder rack for the back of my truck, and he welded it. I helped him weld together my little Rambo bamboo camper I've lived in for 5 years now, mainly on the street, on the side of the road, but still being gainfully employed doing permaculture design and installation in the city. But as they say, for most people, there's only one way to have upward social mobility, and that is to work without paying rent, meaning live in your car or live under a bridge, but still have a job, because you need to save up if you want to invest or have compounding interest or even buy land the way I did. I levered up my upward social mobility by making a sacrifice of being unsheltered beyond mostly living in a car, and then eventually being gifted a truck, and then eventually having the ability to buy a four-wheel drive off-road 10-cylinder, three-quarter-ton truck. And with that, force multiply my truck steadying experience and get the supplies that I needed to have a decent start on this land. So I'm kind of a little bit now more than ever, well, just I'm still dependent on the outside world's economy, but less and less every day, because I catch all my own rainwater. I'm growing a percentage of my food, but not nearly enough. And that's going to be the main struggle for me, is the continuum to go from growing a small percentage to 100% of my food. At that point, as long as my shelters, handmade shelters, hold up, I'm not going to need much from the outside world. I'm not going to care too much about a lot of its problems. But of course, I will always be affected by them. I'll always be subject to the laws and the taxes and the pollution, even though I'm far away from most of it. At least I got out of the city finally. So what is globalism, and what are globalists, and what does that have to do with what happened to anti-globalization? What happened? So that's where it's interesting, is in this Venn diagram, poor leftists and rich rightists, I guess. I don't hear that often, but I don't know why not, because if you're a leftist, obviously there's rightists. So the left wing, the right wing, the poor, the rich, suddenly what used to be called anti-globalization is now the conspiracy theories about the so-called globalists. And how do you compare those? Is it apples and oranges, or what is this semantic sort of collision? It's hard to explain, but I feel like I have consumed enough intelligence about what the globalists are doing and what the anti-globalists are doing that I can make some form of sense out of it. But essentially, I would try to articulate it as that, and this is my first time, so bear with me. If the globalists, which are the boogeyman of the globalism conspiracy theory, which I'm not decided on. You know, I'm not saying it's wrong or bad or foolish. I'm just saying the rhetoric that I'm hearing is very conspiratorial. And so back in my day, we didn't call, well, we were anti-globalization movement, but I never heard anyone say it's the globalists that are the bad guys, that are the villains. You know, to us, there was still this socialist terminological paradigm or baggage, maybe you could say the bosses. So the socialists were out there. Like, what were all the different cacophony of movements in the streets of the WTO? What was on their signs? It wasn't stop the globalists. It was stop globalization. But who was behind globalization? The Wizard of Oz? I mean, what was going on? So the socialists would say it's the bosses, or more broadly speaking, the left and Marxists would say the capitalists, the CEOs, obviously. That was more coming into, yeah, so I think the bosses was more archaic, and more modern at that time would be the CEOs. Stop the CEOs, they're overpaid, they're extracting all of the wealth off the backs of their laborers and creating these free trade agreements in order to extract from all of the rest of the world with no limits. So yeah, I think at that time it was just CEOs and the politicians that were bought off. So okay, what's coming to mind is what someone who I would consider a very academically rigorous, to me very respectable anti-globalist. I listen to a lot of anti-globalists now. A lot of them, I think, are wingnut conspiracy theorists who just enjoy intellectually playing with themselves in order to just kind of have this little playset, which is an ideology of conspiracy action figures that they like to play with in this sandbox of circular logic and half-baked critique and kind of unrigorous social science. I still learn from him. I'm entertained by him. But, you know, there's a lot of anti-globalist conspiracy nuts out there who are very loud and outspoken, and I find them, those types, mostly entertaining. But I'm actually more interested in not just the entertainment value, but in the real rigorous social science. So there's one fellow who I consider to be, to me, the most respectable, reputable PhD who's an anti-globalist, and there's a few, actually, to be honest, but I'm not going to give out any names right now. But I'll say the one that I respect the most has critiques of the establishment that have elements all across the political, all across the left and right. To him it doesn't matter so much what the tradition is, whether it's grouped within the left or the right. It's just, how do we understand this? What are the globalists doing? And how do the globalists strategically play off of the sort of low-level, emotive, knee-jerk groupthink of the left and the right? Because they've co-opted it all. It's almost like the idea that they don't pledge allegiance to any nation. They're not nationalists. They don't, I mean, religion was discarded hundreds of years ago as the mercantilist class of merchants in Europe realized that the decree of the king and the lack of a rule of law and hyper-religiosity and all its divisiveness, those are essentially all bad for business. So dissolve nationhood, dissolve ethnicity, dissolve religion, dissolve borders, so that you could have an infinite marketplace to sell to, an infinite capital resource base to exploit for that purpose of commodifying everything. So shedding nationhood, national identity, shedding borders to create a global singularity of slave consumers and a and a regulatory landscape that is controlled by a small group of a cabal of billionaires and those who are afraid of them and those who are controlled by them and in their pocket. So this gentleman, he would say the donor class, and I don't know how widely that term is used, because I only really hear him saying it, so I don't know if he takes credit for it, but that's where I've heard it first and where I've heard it the most. So the donor class, we would have said, oh yeah, I forgot, the ruling class. That's what we would have said on the streets, on the protest signs. Down with the ruling class, down with the bosses, down with the CEOs. We weren't saying down with the globalists, we weren't saying down with the donor class, but it all means the same thing. Politicians pimp poor people into war, and the ruling class or the donor class pimp politicians into doing their bidding. So it's a pimpocracy then, if you will, or if you want. I definitely don't want it, but that seems to be what it is. Kleptocracy is good. Yeah, oligarchy makes sense, but it's not that catchy of a term. So I'm going to go with pimparchy, pimpocracy, whatever. Doucheocracy is how I'm feeling about the leaders of the world right now, that's for sure. Most of them. Douchebags. But now it's actually going to be tech bros. It's going to be the tech broocracy, the tech broarchy. That's kind of what the billionaire donor class is looking like. But yeah, I don't know. They've got these meetings. They've got their forums and whatnot. Where it's interesting, because the most unpredictable thing for me is that. The globalists, and I guess I'm comfortable saying it, if the globalists figured out the way to co-opt what they're calling ESG, and now they're ruffling the feathers of the libertarians and the more conservative right that doesn't want to be melted into a melting pot with people of racial diversity that they don't care for, or people of, shall we say, orientation diversity that they don't approve of, that if what's best for the bosses, the ruling class, the globalists, the donor class, what's best for them is a pan-humanistic melting pot of enslaved consumers who are, I mean, there's all these cliches now. I don't even want to use them because I don't think they're very useful. I don't think they're as intelligent as what I think there's been a degradation in the intelligence of the, what people say, oh, you're going to eat bugs and be happy not owning anything. I mean, that doesn't really epitomize what's happening very well. Every time I hear people say that, I'm like, who are you trying to convince? Who's going to be motivated and organized by that? It just doesn't seem, it seems like you may as well say it's the UFOs and the grays and the reptilians. I mean, that's about as out of left field, not left field, no, this is out of nowhere. That's about as unrelatable as anything that has, I mean, now you're talking about sounding like new age wing nuts who talk about reptilians and grays and whatnot, which, hey, more power to them, do your thing. But just good luck galvanizing the masses to topple and overthrow anything if you're talking about things that they can't relate to. So, you know what? Something I can relate to is heat stroke and heat exhaustion and being work. I work myself almost to death, to the edge of survival. I work myself in my own human ecology, working. I was my own ruling class, my own boss. I got no one to blame but me for how I worked myself almost to death in the heat last summer. But that's not just me. In fact, I have it easy because I get to rest and be in a state of I'm able to ride the edge of heat exhaustion, 24/7 heat exhaustion, and just monitor my vitals so that I don't die of heat stroke. And that just means not working. But if I do try to work, or if I do have to work, I risk dying of heat stroke. And that goes for all of the farm workers, all of the industrial laborers in warehouses that have not been retrofitted with AC because the bosses don't care to do people care and provide for the needs of their workers, so they get to drop dead and operate, be expected to operate 100% capacity and be forced by the heat down to a 25% or less potential capacity as you experience what's called heat syncope, which is a sort of catalyst for heat illness of all kinds. That's what I've been suffering through. I suffer for 3 to 4 months of heat syncope, which basically causes you to have lethargy and immobilizing, and sometimes extremely excruciating, lack of blood pressure. And it got so bad for me after an injury where I lost a lot of blood to internal bleeding. I couldn't stand, I couldn't walk, I could barely sit up, but I had to survive like that for 2 months until the heat broke and I got a resupply of, I'm going to say it was spinach powder, organic spinach powder and vitamins that luckily I was able to nurse myself back to health, and I was walking again slowly but surely after 2 months. And then after about 3 months, by the time it was in the middle of the fall, I was back to 100%. But with so it's funny that libertarians and conservatives who are against the globalists who are trying to create kind of what they fear to be, or what the anti-globalists fear to be, authoritarian regimes to enforce green living and green energy and green everything because of climate change and global warming. Yeah, I don't see where I get it that it's, if you look at the history of the term hegemony and then you learn about what the European white colonizers were doing in order to, it's important. Yeah, I mean, understanding the history of co-opting resistance is very important, because if the globalists can co-opt the green left and sort of sign their freedom away and sign their autonomy away and end up being beholden to contracts with the cult of the globalists, because they thought that they were, their interests were being served, because we're all singing kumbaya and going green now, but really if the green agenda has been co-opted by the billionaire class for their own sort of vain, narcissistic, wannabe heroics of being green and being delegates of environmental progress, and certainly there are a number of billionaires who I'm aware of who sort of seem to be greenwashing to kind of cleanse their own soul of the guilt of being obscenely powerful in the world. And really, I mean, if you were to relinquish that power and give it to both the center, the left and the right, to solve problems that are on this planet, I think it's obvious who I may be talking about, but I don't want to name names. But I guess it's a very weird, if it's trite to say psyop, but yeah, I mean, it's, to me, it's not that. It's not rocket science. Another apropos reference, but it's not rocket science to know that. Here's the simplest way I'll put it: money goes from dumb people to smart people, and it's the smart people, whether they're smart and hard, like the Navy SEALs and the Marine SOC and the Rangers, all the different elite units that are, they're the smart and hard ones. Because if you're hard and not smart, you get to be the bottom of the barrel regular army, is what the Green Berets would say. I mean, God help you if you don't join special forces and don't make the cut, because you'll be in the bottom of the barrel. And I'm not saying that to be anti-veteran. I'm saying that because I'm just echoing what I heard from those elites. Like, you do not want to be an elite. You don't want to just be hard, meaning brave and willing to be a pawn for the smarter people who either don't fight anymore or never fought a day in their life. But you fight for them, and you defend their wealth, you defend their empire, you defend their offshore drilling, oil drilling stations and mines in pirate-infested waters and rebel-infested nations throughout the Fourth World and the Third World. If you're a soldier and you're a regular army, you're not in the elite groups, then you're there because you didn't do well in the ASVAB test, the placement test, and you didn't have the technical proficiency or the intestinal fortitude to push yourself through Hell Week or well, however you want to look at it. But there are standards in place to sort out whether you're, where you're going to be in the stack, the social hierarchy. I say there's money goes from dumb people to smart people, and the smart people can afford the smart and hard people, even, and just the hard people. But it's the rich people who have the security forces. It's the rich people who direct the commandos, and those commandos, whether for cartels or for the global war on terror. You can be a guerrilla leftist commando, but you're not going to have the money of, it's going to look like the Chiapas Zapatistas versus the U.S.-backed Mexican military death squads. Peter Zion is probably one of the most astute scholars of the geopolitics and how the militaries of the world grease the wheels of capitalism. And it really, yeah, you don't have, your work's cut out for you if you're poor, working class, and you want to rebel against the security forces that the elite play chess with on this geopolitical chessboard of planet Earth. So from globalization to anti-globalization to globalism and anti-globalism, and there's one word that I haven't mentioned yet, which I will accredit the way I credited Donor Class, but I'll mention Peter Zion because I feel like he's kind of, yeah, he's in a category where I feel comfortable mentioning his name. But the idea of de-globalization, something that he's studying, and he's sort of cataloging the decline of Western civilization, decline of the U.S. empire in the world, a retraction from globalization for various reasons, all complex reasons of geopolitics. So, but what's fascinating to me is that, well, I guess I'm extra glad I didn't get my skull crushed by a baton at the Battle of Seattle in 1999 fighting against globalization, because 25 years later, deglobalization would start to happen on its own. It would start to unravel. And the empire would be overstretched, fighting too many wars on too many fronts. It would be inflating its currency. It would be experiencing discord internally. Political and religious divisions would be exploited. And outside, we would be imploding as an empire from the inside out, creating power vacuums and imbalances that would make us easier and easier and easier to be toppled by foreign adversaries. I think Peter Zion is far more bullish on the American empire maintaining its hegemony and dominance in the world, on the world stage, although, while abandoning its previous allies and being under far greater threats of a multipolar. I'm not going to go into paraphrasing all his work. You can certainly avail yourself of it, but it's a very sober, realistical, non-idealistic, non-utopian, sober look at the state of the world. So definitely, the American Empire is in decline. Its decadence is causing it to collapse under its own weight. I think that's pretty obvious. And if the peak of U.S. power was the end of the Cold War, where the only significant counterbalancing force of geopolitics in the world as a superpower, if that was the bipolar world of the U.S. versus Russia and everything and everyone below that, and everyone succumbed to the economic prerogatives and trade routes of the two dominant empires who were in a Cold War with each other, that the peak of the American prowess was the fall of the Soviet Union. And then, since then, drunk on prosperity, we tried to bite off more than we could chew on that Monopoly game board that spans the globe, or the chess board that spans the globe, and we made a lot of enemies, and we spent a lot of blood and treasure. Now we have a lot of disabled veterans and an abysmal recruitment rate and an abysmal sort of standard of fitness and preparedness tactically for war, so that we're just more vulnerable than ever. And our enemies have only gotten stronger and more allied. So the shrinking of the American Empire, its prowess, it's just a result of the decadence and the overextension. If the globalists had been defeated by the anti-globalization movement, and we would have kept jobs at home, there would be more social safety, there would be more cohesion, there wouldn't be a need for extreme socialism or Marxism. The democracy could have just been fine. A democracy, a capitalist democracy that was more self-contained within its borders and solved its own problems, and not over-leveraged into outsourcing and overstretched itself, kind of leaving the average working person in the dust with less and less net worth, and then spending blood and treasure to distribute warriors and kind of burning out and wasting and grinding down and destroying your smart and hard. Bring the troops home, because the war is at home, and it doesn't need to be a bloody war. It needs to be a war of civil engineering and doing what they did after the Dust Bowl, is put the military to work digging swales, permaculture style, without even knowing what it was. But yes, tactical permaculture, that is my flag now. And it's one that is not anti-religious, not anti-conservative, not anti-military, but it is anti-militarism, it's anti-bigotry, it's certainly just simply about the design charrette. Let's all show up as stakeholders at the table, the tabletop exercise of Operation Heal America, if you want. But everyone's got their operation name, everyone's got their organization, whether it's for-profit or non-profit, and everyone's got their party line. For me, it's just as simple as those of us who are certified permaculture designers who try to see things through a non-metaphysical and a earth science positivism lens, which is, this substance is toxic in concentration, this measure or this countermeasure will help to remediate the soil, these weeds will accumulate toxins and pull them out of the soil so it's more safe to grow food in. That's the kind of human ecology realism, the practicality of permaculture that avoids overemphasis on boogeymen and pointing fingers. It's about not caring so much about what the bad guys did or what the bad guys are doing, but what you can do as a good person or gal or guy or however you like to consider yourself, focusing majority efforts on solving the problems nearest to us, the ones that we're creating, the ones that we're affected by, and not spending an excessive amount of time obsessing over conspiracy theories of globalist boogie people. It doesn't, unless you are affected by eminent domain, which is rare, there's no excuse not to be a permaculture homesteader and to speak. I said to myself once a long time ago, when even before I got very into permaculture, just as a leftist revolutionary guerrilla warrior in my early 20s, at one point it dawned on me, I said, we do not have a land base as a movement. We're not like the Zapatistas. We're wandering, mostly white American leftists trying to shack up to the cause of animal rights or the cause of people of color or indigenous people. And we meaning for me, a member of a subculture of white American radical leftists, without a real cohesive land-based ethnic movement to call our own, and we just became these mercenary activists who sometimes were welcomed and sometimes were not welcome in the campaigns and movements that we shacked up to in order to find our souls and feel connected and feel worthwhile as colonizers and settlers. Some people more or less motivated by guilt and shame. Some people more just wanting to express their resistance energy while they had it. Like that was me, you know. And what are you rebelling against? What do you got? I wore out my welcome here and there. I'm still welcome in some places, but for me, it's very personal now because I have my own little reservation. I have my own little piece of land. I'm a white refugee, a white dropout. There were a lot of settlers from Europe who failed to impose their methods of agriculture on the Americas, and they eventually became refugees and joined Native American tribes. That happened a lot. Soldiers went AWOL and joined Native American tribes. And yeah, you know what? I'm not trying to join any tribe. I'm not trying to be Mr. Red Path walking white man with a feather and a pipe. No, that's not me. I've done a lot of time and service to a lot of Native American causes and organizations, and I knew my place, and it was as a delegate of the rebels and dropouts from within the American empire of mainly white folks. So where does all this lead? Where does it all end up? It's just about, yeah, the realization I had earlier in life was that we don't have a land base. We don't have a real ethnic struggle. We're just wandering mercenaries. And if we wanted to have anything like the dignity and the pride and the resolve that you would have as an indigenous land defending warrior, then the best you can do would be to be a guerrilla gardener in your own neighborhood, whether you're sleeping in a dumpster or sleeping in a skyrise. Clean up your own neighborhood with permaculture, and if you can afford land at any scale, clean that land up and become land-based. Have a reason to die and defend your land, because it's what sustains you. Don't just eat out of dumpsters, and don't just work for the man and have a meager existence, but work for the land. And that's my agenda. That's what I'm doing. And with my permaculture training materials that I still have lots of, I have no excuse to fail other than my own weakness or my own stupidity. I like to think I'm smart and hard, but I don't. I chose not to join the Navy SEALs or the Army Rangers. I chose to unite with the warriors that were not serving empire, but were resisting empire. But that does not mean I cannot work hard to be, however dumb I may have started out, I think most of us can achieve a level of smartness and hardness to be warriors. And for me, that's to be an eco-warrior. And to operate within the spheres where I can have the most influence and not the least. So I said to myself, I'm only gonna criticize the system with food, energy, calories that I grow myself. Until then, I'm gonna shut up. Not because I shouldn't have a voice, not because I shouldn't be begging for rights and begging for handouts and begging for wealth redistribution, sitting in a protest, occupying some street corner or something. No, it's all fine and good. But I decided for myself, you know what, I think it's easy to complain. It's hard to make a living off the land, but you're allowed to do that even in a community garden. So there's no excuse, no matter how poor you are. And I can speak from that perspective, no matter how rich you are. And I can speak from having a little bit of, tiny bit of wealth, a micro fortune compared to what I've had most of my life. I can talk to rich people. I can talk to poor people. I understand the monetary system and finance enough now to speak from both perspectives. And I'll tell you what, I was right when I made that decision, when I said, I'm not going to waste a lot of, I'm not going to eat out of a dumpster or eat from cheap toxic food that I bought with a paycheck working for the man. I'm not going to complain with that food energy. I'm going to apply that food energy to learning how to grow my own food. And once I've grown my own food, I will be happy to spend the energy from the food that I grew myself to criticize the system. But you don't bite the hand that feeds you. If I'm sucking at the teat of the system for every calorie that I burn to survive, then I will be the first to die when the system collapses. If you don't grow your own food, you're going to go down with the system that you're trying to take down. So that's, again, tactical permaculture. Why not reprioritize? Not just, oh, you're a prepper, oh, you're a wingnut. No, there's pride and dignity and power in going back to the land and learning how to fight and learning how to defend the land. And if people just did that and stopped being co-opted into the agendas of whoever and signing your soul away, selling your soul to the devils of the globalists, if you will. Like, oh, I want to be green, but I guess that means I got to sell my soul to the globalists and then I'll get top-down greenness. No, bottom-up grassroots, clover roots, because we're not into grass here at Permaculture Inc. No, I'm kidding. Do you. There's plenty of grass around me. It's perfectly, hey, rice. I grow rice. I grow grass. I've grown cane sugar. That's a grass. I grow lemongrass. So how about lemongrass roots or rice grass roots? Just not Bermuda grass, please. I still have nightmares from removing that in the city. Food, not lawns. How about that one? But that's pretty much a good enough rant for now. Does that leave me any less confused? Are you any less confused? Probably not. But let's call it like this. Globalization was countered by the anti-globalization movement. Then globalists co-opted the anti-globalization movement until deglobalization put us all in our place. And I'll either see you at the soup line or I'll see you with picks and shovels out there working some defendable area of land that you and your community can subsist on no matter what is happening at the top, from the top down, which we, until we're the ones directing the smart and hard elite special forces operators, and they're operating on our behalf, not to disable Middle Eastern empires of oil, but to disable the kleptocrats within Western nations. Imagine that. Imagine one day of special operations to disable the globalists, if you want, if you will. I don't care what you call them. I just think it's interesting that more and more every day, I mean, think about in the history of the empires of the world, how many, not even necessarily a coup, but it's when the smart and hard elite military warriors who've been out there losing lives in battle, the elite warriors come back from the hinterlands to the core of the empire, disgusted at the excesses taken by the kleptocrats that were using the warriors as pawns, and there is this cycle. So I'm optimistic that the cynical veterans will join forces with the oppressed that need to be liberated within their own nations, even their own children. Yeah, come home from being a special forces operator in theaters of war abroad and liberate the oppressed of your own children who are obese, addicted to social media, and killing themselves with fentanyl. Now your work's cut out for you, and you can't just sit there at your cozy, air-conditioned forward operating base and bully AK and RPG-wielding, IED-burying tactically inferior adversaries. And I say that with just all due respect to the warrior spirit. And a matter of fact, the Green Berets that I study from now have nothing but love for their the indigenous that they worked with and they trained, that taught them, that invited them into mosques to pray, that invited them for tea, that taught them some customs and developed them, made them the most cultured warriors of the American Empire, the Green Berets. That they get to be the anthropologically informed sort of delegates of the best we could possibly offer when deployed properly to empower, we hope, the forces for democracy that lie dormant under every repressive regime in the world. So I'm not there, believe me, I look up to those operators. I just think it's sad that for all the best efforts that they've made to liberate the oppressed abroad, for all their best and most honest efforts to liberate the oppressed abroad, they come home after 20 years of service in the global war on terror to find their own children and families and communities being terrorized and being abandoned by the globalists who are happy just to see everyone ground down into a state of disempowerment. And hate to say it that way, but maybe there's a lot to talk about as we repair the earth and plant trees and dig swales. Maybe there's a lot to talk about between those of us who aspire to be smart and hard and not be pimped within the pimpocracy of the globalists. All right, enough out of me. Cheers.